will expire at the end of this year. You'll see investment into those type of operations dry up because of it. And, you know, if I've ever seen an opportunity any greater for rural America, it's all about producing energy from the farms, and not just ethanol and biodiesel, which we're all familiar with and in your listening area, but ever increasingly wind and solar, biomass, geothermal. All those things are going to be done in rural America, and that provides two opportunities. One, income for farmers, but also generates economic activities in rural communities. And if we're going to keep our rural communities vibrant economically, and opportunity for young people to stay in the rural communities and live and have jobs, then there couldn't be a better opportunity in at least my lifetime for doing that. You look at a small community with a $50 million ethanol plant built into it, and you see boards coming off storefronts, not the what we've seen for 50 years, and that's boards going up on these small communities, and you lose your tax base, you lose your hospitals, you lose your schools, and pretty soon the community dries up.
Hmm. Let's open our phone lines up and see if any of the listeners are wanting to ask you questions, too. This afternoon, we're talking with the president of the National Farmers Union. His name is Tom Baez. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do that. The number to call is 217-333-9455. That spells out WILL on those last four digits. That's 333-9455. We're in a 217 area code. If you're outside of the listening area and listening on the web, or you'd like to call and talk to us toll-free, you can do that. The number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. You opened up the food v. fuel debate just a bit. Let me take up some of what maybe we can talk about in terms of the economic health of farm communities. Are you fearful at all that if the ethanol plants, and maybe we should take up Iowa in particular, if they were to disappear as quickly as ethanol plants have in the past, in the 1980s, more than half of those plants that were put up, and I don't remember the number, I think about 65 of them, shuttered their doors in a year. What happens to Iowa, which appears to be really pretty dependent upon ethanol, and I suppose the rest of the national community at this point in agriculture?
Right. I do think it impacts the whole national farm economy, because what happened with the increased usage for ethanol is basically we got supply and demand back into balance. For years, we've been overproducing corn and soybeans and wheat and those commodities, and hoping that we'd find a market for them, which often ended up being exports at below cost of production. Well, by adding value, and in this case energy, we've increased that demand, and it not only brought up corn prices, but it brought up prices across the board as you started to see some shifts in production, farmers being able to actually get what they deserve as a profit from the marketplace. And no business can survive without it. So I think overall it's been a good thing. And if the ethanol industry contracts, we'll go back to an excessive amount of production that will depress prices. And if you look at the other side of the ledger, if you look at the inputs, which have skyrocketed because of energy, the real irony here is ethanol production, biodiesel production, is designed to reduce our dependence on foreign oil, which is ironically what's driving up all our imports, is high energy prices. So it does have a tremendous impact, Todd.
We have a phone call on line one this afternoon. Good afternoon, caller. You have a question for Tom Baez, the president of the National Farmers Union?
Oh, yes, I do.
Okay.
With all these subsidies, it seems like everybody wants to get subsidized for something. Who is supposed to pay for all this in the end? We've got Congress is out of control. Spending is out of control. I mean, if we tried everything we could do right now, we're in debt for probably generations.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. The last 6 or 8 years, it seems like we've been spending on everything. And we've had some rough spots that may not have been predictable, like 9/11 and the cost of it. But by and large, you have to get spending under control. In 2000, our economy was in good shape. We actually had a projected budget surplus. So it's all happened in the last 6 or 8 years. And like any entity, government has to get its spending under control. When you're talking about subsidies, and this bailout thing is really important because how they do it, I mean, I think everyone understands something has to happen, but how they do it is the real trick. If you recall, in the mid-'80s, we had a farm credit crisis in which they had to bail out the farm credit system, but it was structured in such a way that they had to pay every dime back plus interest, and they did. We also had the savings and loan crisis and several crises, but you just don't give people a blank check, and that's what I think has a lot of people really concerned, is giving a blank check to bail out people that showed no responsibility and tried to make every dime they can. So when you talk about a $700 billion rescue plan, the devil's in the details. And, I'd be the last person to say bail out Wall Street. I think, you know, what you really have to look at is the impact that it, as it comes downhill back to Main Street, back to rural America. And obviously we're dealing with a very serious crisis. I've never in my history out here seen Congress move as quick when the administration came to them with a problem in trying to deal with major legislation like that. So it is scary. And
it just makes me a little nervous when they do it so quick, actually. I mean, I didn't mean to get off of the ethanol stuff, but it just concerns me when it just seems like everybody wants subsidies. I mean, the ethanol...
Right.
You know, I mean, they're getting, I mean, isn't it's crazy amounts of money, too, and it just...
Yeah. Well, there are no ethanol subsidies to farmers, and I hope everyone understands this. The tax credit, and it's called the blender's tax credit, is the subsidy, and that goes to, ironically, the people that have been fighting ethanol. It goes to the oil industry, that, which refines ethanol into gasoline, or blends the... It's a blender's tax credit. It blends ethanol with gasoline so you can burn it. So that really doesn't go to farmers. And I know that's tough because you even hear some people that know better start to say that. And if you add all that up, it's $4 billion, which is a small amount of the tax incentives that are given to oil companies to produce. So... You know, I think you have to look a little long-term on getting an industry started. Once it's up and running, I think you got to get rid of those subsidies. They can't last forever.
Oh, yeah. Well, oil companies shouldn't be getting any tax credits, as far as I'm concerned.
I think they're doing pretty well, as far as I can see.
I was just curious about how much the farmers or the corn growers get. And just...
Well, on the farmers, and this is always interesting because the media often portrays it as a huge amount. The recent farm bill, this is a 10-year score on the estimate of the price, was $300 billion. And oftentimes people make it sound like that all goes to farm subsidies. It doesn't. 73% of that $300 billion is for nutrition and hunger programs. And actually the amount that goes for farm subsidies, which really are in place to kind of help when times are tough. People get by because you have so many variables that you can't control, like government, trade, and weather. But that the amount to farmers is 0.25%. 0.25% of the entire federal budget. We're talking about companies here in this bailout, individual companies that get far greater amounts than all farmers get, all 2 million farmers over a 10-year period.
Tom.
It's like you have to put this stuff in perspective, and what's the goal here?
Tom, we'll come back in just 2 minutes, and we'll continue our conversation. Thanks for being on the line with us, and if you'll stay with us, we'll talk till right up till near 3 o'clock, okay?
Okay.
All right, thanks to our caller as well. If you'd like to call in, you can do that. It's toll-free, 800-222-9455. That's 222-WILL. Or if you're in the 217 area code, 333-9455. You're listening to the Harvest Hour edition of the Closing Market Report. We're talking with Tom Baez. He's the president of the National Farmers Union.
Today's programs are made possible with support from the Champaign County Humane Society, promoting animal welfare since 1951. Pet adoptions are available from the Humane Society, a proud member of Community Shares of Illinois, a choice for payroll donation at work, on the web at cs-il.org.
Taking a look at what the weather forecast looks like for the two-state region from our own Ed Keiser. He says tonight in the north, mostly cloudy skies, a few scattered light showers. In central sections, partly to mostly cloudy. In the south, clear to partly cloudy. Lows generally between 40 and 45. Expect around 50 if you live near Lake Michigan. Tomorrow in northern Indiana and northeastern Illinois, mostly cloudy. A few scattered sprinkles early, then partly sunny elsewhere. Intervals of clouds and some sunshine. Highs tomorrow will range from 60 in the far north to 75 in the far southern part of Illinois. Temps should trend upward. High Saturday will range from the 60s in the north to the 70s. And then high Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday will be mostly in the 70s and the low 80s. Overnight lows will rise into the 50s next week. The warmer weather will aid, of course, crop maturation and harvesting. A few scattered showers possible on Sunday into Monday. Those will primarily be in northern Illinois and Indiana. Most central and southern locations will likely stay dry through Monday, and that should favor harvest operations.
WILL programming is made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, featuring locally grown and organic produce, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar, and bulk foods department. Strawberry Fields also offers natural vitamins, health and beauty products, household cleaning products, pet foods, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report. This is the Harvest Hour edition this afternoon. We're talking with the president of the National Farmers Union. He's been in that seat since 2006 when he was elected. Thanks for staying with us, Tom Bias. We appreciate you being with us this afternoon. I have a quick question for you. Do your brothers agree with most of what you have to say?
Do they agree with?
Well, they farm. I'm just wondering. You can say yes or no and move on.
Them. You know, I'm the middle of I'm the middle brother.
Oh, you're the, well, in that case, no.
I'm the one sort of trying to pull them together. How's that?
All right. That's good enough. It probably wasn't a fair question, but it popped into my mind.
No, ask them. They're both members of Farmers Union, so they haven't canceled their membership yet.
Well, there you go. I suppose they have their say in that case, one way or the other, don't they? Well, tell me about the Farmers Union. What is it?
Well, the Farmers Union was founded 106 years ago in Point, Texas. And it was basically around the premise of 10 people got together. They were tired of getting below cost of production below what they paid to produce a crop in the marketplace of producing raw commodities. And they decided to start to add value. And they started by creating some co-ops. It has grown, obviously, from 10 people then. We have about 250,000 members, family memberships today. So every member of the family is a member, if one person is. And we're a general farm organization, which means we represent producers of all types from all different types of commodities all around the country. Our policy is all developed by our members. It's grassroots up, starts at the local level, moves to the state, and then is adopted by the national. And we don't represent other interests of agriculture. It's just generally family farmers, ranchers, and rural communities, and we're all funded by through that process. So there's never any doubt about who we represent.
Two topics I want to take up, and we started in on one of them, but I want to go more in depth in just a bit on credit. The other one is COOL, or country of origin labeling. Can you tell me about it?
Oh, yeah. The country of origin labeling is something that we've been advocating for a number of years. We got it into the 2002 Farm Bill. And then the people who don't want to label the products that come into this country or produced in this country from their origin kept getting delays after delay after delay in Congress to put off the implementation. So in this Farm Bill, we went back to work. We sat down with the big packers and processors that have always opposed labeling, and we worked out some agreements. And then when the rules were written, USDA gave them some flexibility on implementation, and basically, Todd, they took this little flexibility provision and thought it was an opening big enough to drive a combine with a 30-foot header to it. And what they're ending up doing on the beef side is they're not going to label U.S. product as U.S. product. They're going to put it into a category which I call a NAFTA label, which is product of U.S., Canada, and Mexico. And 90%, 90 to 95%, depending on who you ask, of all the beef slaughtered that goes into the stores for muscle cuts, et cetera, is born, raised, and slaughtered in the United States. And we have no problems if other countries want to compete with us, but be proud enough to put your name on it. And let's tell the consumer, let's let the consumer differentiate or have the means to differentiate our high-quality products from the United States with our competition.
Hey, that comment on the 30-foot header only reminded me, because of size, about the 10-acre rule. I had a discussion with Doug Yoder, who's with the Illinois Farm Bureau. I had called and talked to him about baseball, actually, and traveling league for the boys.
White Sox?
No, traveling league for the young boys. He and I both have kids that are in traveling leagues. But I asked him about the 10-acre rule. I did not understand that of the farmers, I think in Illinois, there were 27,000 farms that were impacted by this. I thought it was really just the small farms, but it's the way the FSA has divided up farms in the past, and that they need to be put back together. For instance, a 40-acre field, say, with my brothers, I have five brothers, there'd be six of us, so there would be each, if we each had a share in FSA, put it down all as smaller than 10 acres, of course, as separate farms, that would create a problem in the coming year. Do you think it's a good thing that Congress managed to fix that at least for a year?
Out front on getting that change, because actually the Farm Bill had intended for USDA to implement it in such a manner that they aggregated those acreage.
Right.
And USDA, for whatever reason, you know, don't seem to be following the intent of the law and what Congress intended on implementing it. Also, the new acre program, the permanent disaster program, which is going to affect a lot of your viewers that got hit by floods, as well as country of origin labeling. And I don't understand why. So Congress had to step in on the 10-acre rule and the permanent disaster provision, for example, on it. It's called the SURE program, mm-hmm, at USDA. If your crop was flooded out this spring with all those excessive rains, and you took the crop insurance indemnity on that crop, then you're ineligible to take the buy crop insurance if you replant it. And many people did replant.